Hello, I'm Ross Cabbage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, I was thinking how I should introduce him. He's someone who's really been on both sides of the regulatory divide in oncology. And my guest today is Dr. Gidon Blumenthal. Gidon, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Yeah, sure, Ross. Thanks so much for having me. So as you described it, I'm a medical oncologist who has had an interesting career path, serving both at the U.S. FDA for over a decade, and most recently in industry. I'm currently the vice president in clinical development in the asset groups in Merck in oncology. And before that, was a vice president in regulatory affairs in Merck. And on a personal level, also a husband and a dad living here in the outskirts of Washington, D.C.
How many kids have you got?
I have three kids, one in college, just started her senior year, and two in high school.
Nice. Boys or girls?
Two girls sandwiched in the middle, right in the middle, with a boy. They can keep him in line and teach him the ways of the world.
Where did you meet your wife?
Met my wife, Lisa, at an undergraduate at Washington University in St. Louis. We actually were both from the Washington, D.C. area and had a few friends in common. And throughout my college years, these friends told us that we really should meet. And then miraculously, we did meet towards the end of my college career when I was a senior and she was a junior, and we've been together ever since.
And then what was her degree, and is she looking after the three kids, or did she go out to work too?
Yes, she works professionally. She has a master's actually in deaf education. She's not hard of hearing herself, but she's always specialized in hard of hearing as well as special education. She currently works in the public schools, working with elementary school kids on reading and English as a second language.
There we go. And I started with all those questions because it's like, let's put you into context. All right, but let's start with the young Gidon. So where were you born and where were you brought up?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., area. My parents were both immigrants. My mom from Israel. My dad was actually born in Indonesia, grew up in Holland. They were both scientists, and they worked at the National Institutes of Health. So yeah, I grew up here in the DC area as a child of scientists working in the federal workforce.
And I think you said your dad did HIV research. What did your mom do?
Yeah, my dad was involved in, he's a physical chemist, so studying how viruses and different molecules enter into the cell. And so he became, during the HIV crisis, he became very interested in HIV research. How does the HIV virus enter the cell? And then later in his career, he actually did work somewhat on cancer. He headed a nano technology unit at the NCI, looking at, you know, very, very small particles and delivery mechanisms for new cancer drugs. My mom worked more in the mental health field, working on diseases like schizophrenia and depression.
And she was lab-based too?
Yes, she was. She was also lab-based.
So I think you told me you're the youngest of three. So there's three kids growing up in the DC area. Both parents are federal employees. Both of them are scientists. I mean, what was that like? I mean, it's the only one you experienced, so it's a hard question to answer. But you're just immersed in science from an early age?
Yes, we were. And we grew up around a lot of my parents' friends were also scientists as well. So we were immersed in that culture. Interestingly, and if you had talked to my parents, you know, when we were probably in college age, none of us were really headed in that direction. My brother is more of a foreign policy expert, and my sister does a lot of computer work. And I was, as an undergrad, also headed more towards the humanities. But somehow I caught the science bug and started taking science classes first in neuroscience, and then I became more and more interested in other avenues in medicine. And that's what inspired me eventually to go into the medical field.
Your undergraduate degree was in Washington University in St. Louis, and which I always mispronounce. Sometimes I say St. Louis, and they go, no, that's only in the movie. But you did psychology and history, but even during that, you were doing some science classes?
Yeah, I started kind of later in my undergraduate career. So while my friends were kind of, in the senior year, matriculating, headed to the bars, I was, studying organic chemistry and trying to catch up to all the pre-med requirements. So I was a bit of a late bloomer, but eventually I took all the requisite classes and, in the MCAT and, working in the lab to catch up to be able to eventually be able to apply to medical school.
I saw that. So if you do the math, there's a sort of 2-year gap on your CV between your BA in history and psychology, and then you starting in medical school. So was that you needed a break? Was that you needed that time to get the credits to get into medical school? I mean, what did you do in the 2 years?
No, exactly. Very, very keen dissection of the CV, Ross. Yes, I actually spent an extra year. My future wife had another year at WashU in St. Louis. So I spent 1 year at WashU, kind of finishing up all of my requirements, taking the MCAT, working in a neuroscience lab at WashU. And then the second year, I actually worked at a lab at the National Institutes of Mental Health doing functional neuroimaging work on Parkinson's and schizophrenia. And then once I got into med school, I had a few months in between, I actually got to backpack. I traveled to Vietnam and Cambodia and Thailand and Nepal.
That's cool. I'm glad you did that, and you weren't just the guy hitting the books. So I love that.
Yeah.
And so eventually you went to, clearly you don't like traveling too much. You went to the University of Maryland in Baltimore because it's not like a million miles away.
Correct. Yeah, I stayed true to my roots in Baltimore, the state medical school, both for my medical school and then for my internal medicine residency. I also stayed close to home, just down the road in Baltimore.
And did you maintain your interest in neuroscience? I mean, clearly not, because you're now an oncologist. But when was the transition?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was always, and I still am, very interested in neuroscience and psychology. I think really exposure to different mentors, both in medical school and then even on into residency, when you're trying to figure out whether you want to become a primary care physician or a specialist. Some of the mentors I had in oncology just really drew me to that field. I think with neurology, I was also very interested, but I found that at least at the time, you could be a master diagnostician, find the lesion, figure out what the underlying cause of the neurologic sequelae are, but there weren't a lot of treatments available at the time to treat various neurologic ailments. Whereas in oncology, I really had great mentors. I really became passionate and fascinated with the whole drug development process. And there were so many different pathways and targets to explore, and you know, such high unmet need to figure out how to treat patients with various oncologic conditions. And I also felt like oncology, and you know this quite well, is very unique. You get to be very close to the patients in a very vulnerable oftentimes tragic part of their lives, and kind of seeing them through their journey. Sometimes it can be a good ending if they're cured of their disease and maybe become kind of long-term survivors, or oftentimes, unfortunately, they succumb to their disease. But being there for them during that tragic episode in their lives and getting to know their family members, I mean, it's a very intense field, but I kind of got drawn into the field very early on in medical school and then in residency training.
I think you said one of your mentors was a leukemia expert.
That's right. So one of my experts who was at the University of Maryland and then later moved to Hopkins, and I did some research work with her when she moved across town to Johns Hopkins, was Judy Karp. She was, you know, I think one of the first females to really advance to a very high level in academia. And just, I think, you know, to be a woman, to be anyone, a man or a woman in medicine, you have to be tough, and dealing with leukemia patients is so hard. You're dealing with mortality on a daily basis, but particularly to be a woman, I think at that time you had to have a very thick skin. She was very inspirational mentor, watching her with her patients and look at the science and clinical trials behind leukemia. That really drew me in and inspired me to become an oncologist.
So one of the, I mean, this could just be, you know, your pattern, but where you chose to do your hematology and oncology fellowship, because you double boarded, right?
Correct.
You went to the NCI, which again is like, you know, one stop on the underground. I mean, it's not that far away. But why the NCI? Apart from the fact your parents worked there, you know, you had experience of, well, not the NCI, but the National Institutes of Health.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, this was really in the backyard of where I grew up. I think I was always, in my mind, I kind of had this idyllic vision of the NIH. And I still do to some extent, you know, as this place where people come from all over the world to further the science, to investigate, you know, novel pathways, novel discoveries. Growing up, I didn't know as much about the NCI Clinical Center or the NIH Clinical Center, which is the largest freestanding research hospital in the world, just solely devoted to clinical research. They have no emergency room because they don't see any standard of care patients. So it's every patient who's seen there is on a clinical trial. So at the time when I was thinking about fellowship, again, I was really driven to understand more about translational oncology, you know, taking discovery from the bench to the bedside and then taking observations from the bedside back to the bench. And, you know, how do we bring novel drugs to patients through clinical trials? And I just felt like the NCI fellowship was the best opportunity to learn drug development that afforded, you know, the best opportunities of any other. So that's why I chose the NCI fellowship.
And then just to pick up on your prior point, in terms of standard of care and routine care of oncology patients, how did you get exposure to that?
As an NCI fellow, because there's no standard of care patients who come in to the clinic there, you do get exposure through working at what was at the time the Naval Hospital. Now it's called Walter Reed Medical Center. but it's right across the street in Bethesda, Maryland. And actually, I was working with a thoracic oncologist in my fellowship, Dr. Phil Dennis, and he had a clinic and a lab that was actually based out of the Naval Hospital. So a lot of my sort of bread and butter oncology experience was generated at the Naval Hospital. And then you also do rotations at other academic hospitals in the area, Hopkins, Georgetown, Washington Hospital Center. So they do try to expose you to sort of the standard of care, not just novel agent X, Y, and Z.
So we're going to get into the FDA in a second. So, but as you're going through your fellowship, in your mind, what are you thinking? I mean, you know, you double boarded in hematology oncology, private practice, academia. What were you thinking? How did you evolve?
Yeah. So I always wanted to, I always thought of myself as a academic oncologist who would work at an academic medical center, see patients, write grants. By that time, I was pretty sure that unlike my parents, I was not going to be working in the lab pipetting. I'd be interacting a lot with basic and translational scientists, but the sort of the basic research component wasn't necessarily for me. But my plans as an academic oncologist got a little bit sidetracked because one of the fellows a year ahead of me, she had done a rotation at the FDA, and she told me, "Oh, you have to check this place out. You know, it's really fascinating. You really learn a lot about drug development." And I had never really even considered FDA as a potential career path, but I was intrigued by her endorsement, and I went over to interview at the FDA. And that sort of changed my career trajectory because I met Dr. Richard Pazder, who was and still is the head of oncology there. And I was very smitten by his overarching vision of, about where he wanted to take the oncology office at the FDA. And I was intrigued by some of the opportunities and visibility within drug development that you get at the FDA that I decided ultimately that I would try my hand at the FDA and see how it goes. And then, you know, things didn't work out, I could always go back to the academic path ultimately.
Yeah, I think so. You started at the FDA in what year? 2009?
Correct.
And I asked you this the other day when we chatted. It's like, okay, this is a totally different field. It's not kind of like, oh, well, you know, I've been looking after patients, I know what to do, now I'm intending. So how do they even train you? In fact, what was your first title? It was like secret agent or something like that.
Right. And actually, Dr. Pazder always made fun of this title because it sounds like, yeah, it sounds like you're a secret agent or parachuting off an airplane or deployed somewhere. Yeah, I was a medical officer in my initial job at the FDA. And basically, the job as a medical officer, when you're first hired, you really don't know a lot about, you know, the regulatory side of drug development at that point. You know, I was fresh out of fellowship training, and essentially you're reviewing all sorts of drug applications from early first in human clinical trials, the what's called the IND, the investigational new drug application, to, you know, end of phase one meetings, end of phase two meetings, pre-phase three, all the way up to the new drug application when a sponsor, you know, they are successful in their phase three clinical trial. They come to the FDA and they say, we want to market this drug. We want patients to have this drug available in the United States. And they come in, these clerks clinical trials can often be hundreds or even thousands of patients, millions and more of data points. And the FDA gets all of the details of the trial, all of the data points, and through a multifaceted team is charged with reviewing all that data to make sure that the drug is safe and effective, the benefit risk profile is favorable, such that it can be approved in the U.S. So it's really a big undertaking. Before there were computers, this data used to be come in on U-Haul trucks to the FDA, and the reviewers would have to go, you know, into all the paperwork. But thankfully, now with big data, there's no U-Haul trucks backing into the FDA offices in White Oak to review these applications.
So how did they train you? I think you had a cute description of what the job was like in terms of two things at the same time.
Yeah, so one of my mentors, Joe Gutenberg, he used to say that, and this was one of his selling points to get new reviewers into the FDA. It was a very well paid for a federal official type of position, but it was also a graduate school program at the same time. So for the first 2 years, you're taking a lot of coursework on the nuts and bolts of clinical trials, everything from, you know, the ethical considerations, the Declaration of Helsinki, good clinical practices, to how is a drug or a biologic manufactured, what are the laws and rules that govern manufacturing, to biostatistics, to clinical pharmacology and toxicology. How do we make sure that, you know, we study the drug you know, before it's introduced into humans, to all the different phases of clinical trials. Phase one, where you're establishing a safe dose. Phase two, where you're establishing activity and proof of concept and combinability and understanding the pharmacodynamics of the drug. And then, you know, how do you optimally design a phase three study? What are the endpoints that you would use to prove that a drug is effective? So all of these considerations that you get in this you know, graduate program while you're on the job. And then there's sort of on the job training, you know, when you're delving into an application, you're working with your team leader, you're working with, you know, your biostatistician, your pharmacologist, your toxicologist, and this very multidisciplinary approach to understanding all facets of drug development.
Who tends to be the team leader?
Team leader is someone more of a seasoned clinician who had been at the FDA for a number of years. So, for example, a few years into my tenure at FDA, I became the team leader for a thoracic and head and neck oncology. So I was kind of managing a group of reviewers who were seeing all of the applications in lung cancer, which at the time was a very dynamic time in lung cancer. As you well recall, you know, this is kind of the onset, the advent of the anti-PD-1, PD-L1 agents, all, you know, many of the targeted therapies that we think about, like EGFR inhibitors, third generation EGFR inhibitors, ALK inhibitors, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a very exciting time to be at the FDA.
It's interesting, but how do you measure your success? Is an approval a success? I guess it is, but is kind of catching something that shouldn't be approved a success?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a philosophical point. I mean, I think it can't be only the number of approvals. I think that's one biomarker or surrogate of success, because obviously if you're approving a lot of agents and they've undergone rigorous testing and evaluation, that's a good proxy for the overall you know, biopharmaceutical drug development sector, that you know, things are moving through from basic discovery to drug development to approvals. That means the system is working well. But you raise a good point. I think also finding drugs that don't work, and being able to take them, you know, for a public discussion at the Oncologic Drug Advisory Committee, that can also, you know, be the sign of a well-functioning health authority. If we were only just rubber stamping drugs and only approving everything that you know comes through the door, then you know that's not an intact system. So I think, you know, having that predictability, transparency, I think FDA does a good job at that. Some other health authorities, like the European Medicine Agency, their advisory committees are all done behind closed doors, whereas FDA is done in public. So that's really helpful, I think, for drug developers to understand, you know, why a drug application wasn't necessarily ready or suitable for approval at the time.
Yeah, the ODAC, the Oncology Drug Advisory Committee, you know, it's televised. I mean, you can watch it. Whereas when I looked at stuff for the EMA, they didn't tell you who's on the committee. It's like it's a secret.
Right. Oh, totally. That, I think, is one of the crown jewels of drug development are those ODAC meetings. You can learn so much just listening. And now they're all on YouTube, so it's very easy to access.
Yes, you want to fall asleep, you can just watch them.
Right.
So when you were there, this is my recollection of you, is this was the first time I had interacted with somebody from the FDA who I felt was a real card-carrying academic, a curious scientist. And I don't know whether you were the first, maybe you're just the first I interacted with, but the fact that you had all these data points in your back pocket, and then you decided to use them. You decided to say, well, you know, we can do our own analyses and compare between trials. And were you the start of that?
No, I wouldn't say I was the start of it. Actually, my team leader, when I first came to the FDA, I was doing a lot of breast cancer applications. My team leader was someone by the name of Patricia Cortazar. And she actually did this. I think it's definitely the most cited publication that I've been on. She did this meta-analysis with a bunch of different cooperative groups, the German group, the U.S. cooperative groups, this huge meta-analysis looking at a neoadjuvant treatment in breast cancer. And it was very sophisticated analysis looking at triple negative breast cancer, HER2 positive, HER2 negative, HR positive. And it was really useful for the field and move things forward to put forward a guidance document, which under certain circumstances allowed an accelerated approval based on pathologic complete response for breast cancer. So she was one of the first. There probably were others, but she kind of inspired me to conduct some of these analyses that I think you're referring to in lung cancer when I was a team leader for lung cancer. I think at the FDA, you have a very unique position because you do get the data sets across a number of different new drug applications or biologic licensing applications. So you do have an opportunity to conduct sort of independent meta research. And I did do some of that work, which, established, for example, that response rates and progression-free survival correlated quite well in non-small cell lung cancer. But the correlations with overall survival were not as robust. So yeah, those were very interesting analyses and really helped, I think, to contribute to the field. And Dr. Pazder always encouraged that. He didn't want us to kind of be like these monks, living behind these high gates and never interacting with the outside world. He thought the best regulators are ones who, you know, go out there, go to meetings, interact with academics and investigators and patients and even sponsors under the right conditions And that's when you learn the most about, you know, what are the issues most impacting upon, you know, the, you know, the groups and diseases that you help to regulate.
You raise a very interesting point, because obviously the decisions that you're involved with carry with them millions and millions of dollars of implications in terms of, you know, if the drug is turned down, you can't sell it, and they've wasted all that developer money. If it is approved, you know, suddenly it can be a cash cow for a drug company. So people want to get inside your head. The sponsors want to get inside your head. How do you maintain your integrity in that situation?
Yeah, I think you have to kind of walk a fine line, because you do want to be transparent. But you also, you know, you need to obviously be fair and ensure a level playing field. You don't want to, you know, display or project information for some, but not for others. So that's where the transparency is key. But you also, you know, FDA is such a large institution, and relies a lot on precedents. You know, what did we do before? And how does that impact, you know, future drug development decisions? You have to be very careful about not making new policy from a podium. So that's why I think if you talk to a lot of FDA officials, and I think Dr. Pazur does this very well, you know, he says interesting things and things that drug developers can take, and he's very transparent in his dialogue. But he's also careful. Like he tends not to say things that can be, you know, misinterpreted. So it is a very delicate tightrope that you have to walk. I think maybe politicians have to do this to satisfy various constituents too. So it's something that you have to kind of learn as you gain more experience, more leadership opportunities, and. It also, frankly, being in on the sponsor side and in private industry, when you're representing a company, you also have to learn that skill as well.
Yeah, I can imagine so. Let me ask you one question. I think I told you I was going to ask you this one. So I always get asked, you know, when I'm consulting for various companies, it's like, what does the agency think? And my usual response is, well, the agency isn't one person. And so there are individuals, and sometimes they think differently. But how do you avoid the fact that if I'm a drug company and I, you know, get reviewer X, I might get a different answer from reviewer Y? I mean, or does that happen? Is there some kind of oversight and says, no, we have to have consistency?
Yeah, no, I mean, FDA officials, like you said, it's a very complex organization. One thing I always tell folks at Merck is that, you know, these are human beings just like you and me, you know. They have their own good days and bad days. And, you know, if they ask for, you know, a certain study or, you know, impose certain requirements which seem overly burdensome, you know, always assume positive intents. Like they might be seeing things from other sponsors that we're not privy to. So they have some access that, you know, a single sponsor may not have full exposure to. But I do think, you know, and this is when I became the deputy director in the Oncology Center of Excellence, I think the consistency piece is very important, making sure the different review divisions, the different teams, you know, to the extent possible, each drug and each development program is highly nuanced. So you can't be fully consistent. It's not like you can just plug something into ChatGPT or into, you know, Excel spreadsheet and through some algorithm get an output. But we did try to instill consistency across the various review teams, review divisions. And I think one of the ways to do that is just to ensure, you know, a robust dialogue, you know, frequent touch points, frequent meetings, just to make sure that we're all kind of giving similar advice across the board when it makes sense to do so.
I think you said that, you know, you were there for over a decade. So I think your tenure there finished in January 2020. We'll get to where you went to in a second, but during those nearly 11 years at the FDA, do you have things you're most proud of? Do you have things that you're like, that was the biggest mistake I ever made? Within what you feel comfortable publicly disclosing.
Yeah. No, it was really an incredible experience to be there. I think, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of looking back is just helping to stand up this oncology center of excellence. This was outsprung from the 21st Century Cures Act and was part of the Cancer Moonshot. There was this idea from Congress to stand up a center that would unify the drug development efforts across the different product centers at the agency. So for those who aren't complete agency geeks like myself, you know, there's a Center for Drug Evaluation and Research that's also called CDER, which oversees a lot of the small molecule, the monoclonal antibodies, now the antibody drug conjugates, T-cell engagers. There's also the Center for Biologic Evaluation Research, which oversees the cell and gene therapies. Think about, you know, CAR T-cells, T-cell receptor therapies, and personalized cancer vaccines. And then there's CDRH, which oversees a lot of the companion diagnostic in vitro diagnostics. So, you know, when you go to see your oncologist, you don't see like a monoclonal antibody doctor and a vaccine doctor and a you know, diagnostic. You know, the oncology practice, as you well know, is so integrated between all these modalities. So there was a need to sort of integrate the different centers within the FDA, and standing up, you know, the Center of Excellence, which kind of helped to harmonize the reviews and better integrate the different centers, was really an awesome experience and something I've taken onwards into the next phase of my career.
How much were you involved with politicians? Were you insulated from them, or are they part of the day? Just, you know, that's what the FDA, you know, that's just the job.
No, we were pretty well insulated. I mean, I think historically the commissioner's office was kind of like this heat shield that insulated the civil servants and the career staff from politicians. Sometimes you would get a notification from the Hill on, you know, for example, if a constituent in someone's district needed, you know, compassionate use and things like that. Sometimes you would get involved in some of those cases. But, you know, for the most part, we were pretty well shielded from the day-to-day politics.
Okay. So after nearly 11 years, so beginning of 2020, why change? And you know, was the same commute getting boring? I mean, like 20 minutes from your house or something?
Right. No, I had a pretty great commute. I loved the people I was working with. So it was a great job. So after I started my search, I recused myself and started searching, you know, for private sector positions. I at times scratch my head, like, do I really want to do this? Yeah. But ultimately, I think it was the right call. I felt like at the time I was a bit plateauing in my knowledge and skills acquisition. I mean, I think I would have been very happy as a civil servant, like my parents. But I also had kind of an itch to be on the side where you actually directly develop new therapeutics and kind of understanding the mechanics and the decision points. Like, what does it take to actually take a drug from discovery through FDA approval? So that was kind of the motivating force behind why I decided to leave the agency and pursue my next phase of my career in the biopharmaceutical industry.
And you touched on it earlier, but the obvious place to go into is regulatory affairs in large pharma, which is what you did, because you've been on the other side of the fence and you know the dead ends and the secret pathways potentially. You went to Merck, which is huge pharma. How was that suddenly being on the other side? Did it feel conflicted?
Yeah, it was quite a transition. It was during COVID, which was kind of a unique time period for all of us. There are set rules once you leave the agency. There's kind of what they call sort of a cooling off period, where you're not allowed to directly interface with the agency for a period of time. You can provide advice to the company that you're employed by, but you're not supposed to present or represent yourself in front of the agency. But, for me, having been so steeped in sort of U.S. Regulatory considerations, it was also a steep learning curve. First of all, just learning about industry and the company and some of the facets that you don't necessarily interact with within a company when you're at the FDA, like the commercial group, the business development group that looks at new assets, new modalities, and also learning about international regulations. So learning about how the EMA, the rules governing clinical trials in Europe, in China, in Japan, and other parts of the world. I mean, that was a whole eye-opening experience for me, where, at the FDA, we would have monthly conferences with our counterparts in Europe and Japan and Switzerland, et cetera. But once I was at Merck and dealing with the folks in country who day-to-day deal with the regulations and the regulatory authorities in their various countries and regions, I think that was also a very big learning experience for me.
Does pharma tend to prioritize one regulatory authority in the world over others, or just in times of timing?
Oh, no, definitely, for the most part. I mean, certainly in oncology, the U.S. is definitely prioritized in terms of, it's typically the first country where a new drug application is filed. Following a U.S. filing, then, the Europe, Japan, China, and then, some of the other countries follow suit. But yeah, definitely the U.S. is kind of the focal point. There's been a lot of talk recently about, for example, most favored nation and the pricing of drugs. And some of that, I think, is economic, that the U.S. is the market where companies get the most robust return on their R&D dollars compared to some of the other countries. But that's not to say other countries are not important, but U.S. tends to be the primary focus.
And then are there other places that just peg their approvals to the FDA? I mean, it sounds like Europe and China and Japan have their own independent process, but I mean, are there others that are, I don't want to say rubber stamping, but they're saying like the FDA, we can't replicate that in our smaller country, but we're just going to say they've done the work for us?
Yes, there is a reliance pathway. So certain small countries that don't, they don't have the resources to independently review, they'll rely on the FDA, or some of them are kind of, or the EMA, they'll take either review. And then there's a new program, actually when I was at the FDA and the Oncology Center of Excellence, it had just started. It was Dr. Pazder's brainchild called Project Orbis, which is a collaborative review between a number of different health authorities, including Health Canada, Swissmedic. The list has grown on and on. Brazil, Israel, to have either a concurrent review of applications or sequential, but there's a lot of sharing of information to help streamline and facilitate the reviews of these applications.
I've thought of a controversial question. Are you ready for it?
Sure.
So one of the things that influences drugs getting approved, sometimes early approval, is unmet need.
Yep.
Is cost effectiveness an unmet need? So is a cheaper version of an equally effective drug an unmet need?
Great question. I think the old school answer is no. FDA doesn't take into account cost when it's doing benefit risk considerations. That being said, you know, I think this administration, Commissioner Macri, we'll see how they roll out this new policy. They do have this national commissioner's priority review voucher, and there's no statute, to my knowledge, behind it yet. And I'm not exactly sure how it's going to be applied, but they do talk about drugs that are in the national interest. They will go to the top of the queue. So stay tuned. I don't know if cost or some other national security imperative will be factored into this calculus, but it is a strong focus, I think, of both political parties are to try to figure out ways to try to bring costs of drugs down to, you know, to the American public.
All right, let's go back to you at Merck. So you start off in the somewhat sideways move to regulatory affairs, really playing on your strengths, and you do that for about 3 years. And then you have a little change inside Merck.
Right. So when I first joined Merck, I felt like you know, the regulatory affairs would be, like you said, a comfortable place to start to learn the industry. But then over time, you know, as I became more comfortable within regulatory affairs, I sought to pivot back to my roots as an oncologist, as a drug developer, into clinical development and my leadership, at Merck. They were, you know, they were flexible enough to sort of accommodate this transition. So I moved over about 2 years ago into a clinical development position where I'm leading a section, supervising a number of team leaders that are developing new assets. So Merck, as you know, for the last 10 years or so, in oncology, there have been other drugs in the pipeline, but essentially has been, you know, one major drug, and that's pembrolizumab or Keytruda.
The Pembro company, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's it. I mean, I think before I even went into oncology, the idea that one drug can financially support a massive organization was just a shock to me. But it is the blockbusters that really, you know, feed the engine.
Yes, exactly. And you know, pembrolizumab, drugs like Keytruda have really rewritten the textbooks in oncology. I mean, that you could harness the immune system to attack cancer cells. And maybe, you know, from fellowship would have thought maybe melanoma, kidney cancer. Yeah, their immunotherapy may have a place, but who would have thought that in non-small cell lung cancer, breast cancer, endometrial cancer, you know, there'd be a place for immunotherapy. So, yeah, so pembrolizumab has really changed oncology and drugs like it. You know, it has over 30 indications now treating many, many different tumor types. But you know, Merck has had to change recently because, as our chief medical officer, Elia Barr, says, you know, we were once in a unipolar world. We just had Keytruda. Now we're in a multipolar world where we have to develop multiple assets with many different modalities to kind of follow in the wings of pembrolizumab. So that's what we were tasked with. We kind of reorganized, whereas in the past we had over 25 tumor-specific teams. We wanted to maintain that structure with a deep tumor-specific knowledge, but we also wanted to build an asset group that would be focused more on the end-to-end development of a specific asset, working with the tumor teams to figure out, you know, the strategy within a specific tumor type. So that's kind of the evolving structure of Merck Oncology now, whereas we have these asset teams working with the tumor teams to figure out in this multipolar world, you know, what are the best drugs in the pipeline to progress within certain tumor types and different stages of disease.
It sounds super exciting. I got one silly question. So did you have to move house? Did you actually have to lengthen your commute?
No, I was fortunate and they were very flexible with me. I didn't, you know, with kids in high school and at the time in middle school, I did not have to move. So I do commute. Luckily, I'm on the East Coast. So it's not a huge schlep to get up to Pennsylvania or to New Jersey. So I just commute as needed. There's a small presence as well in the DC area. So fortunately, fortunately for myself and my family, we didn't have to move.
I think that's cool. I mean, your path to get there has been a fascinating one. If we look forward about 5 years, what are you looking forward to, but either personally or professionally? Maybe the kids will have left home by then.
I think we're at this interesting inflection point in oncology where we've tasted the promise of some of these modalities, including immune checkpoint inhibitors like Pembro and targeted therapies like osimertinib and crizotinib. T-cell engagers now are starting to come into solid tumors. We have antibody drug conjugates. I mean, we've seen with enfortumab vedotin and trastuzumab deruxtecan, I mean, the great promise. And then we're seeing promise when you combine ADCs and PD-1s. So I think there's so much possibility now. And then layering onto that, the ability of new biomarkers, be it either digital pathology, using AI to detect novel predictive biomarkers that the human eye can't see, or looking at radiomics, ways to analyze imaging, you know, beyond traditional metrics like response rates by RECIST, looking at circulating tumor DNA changes. I think we're kind of at the precipice of radical changes on how we treat cancer. So that really gets me excited and motivates me for what the future beholds in oncology.
And what about Dr. Blumenthal's husband and father?
Yeah, I mean, similar to not to analogize my kids to or my marriage to a drug, but it's you know, watching your kids progress through the pipeline, if you will, and you know, go from, you know, babies to toddlers to, you know, adolescents and onwards to young adults. I mean, that's been a lot of fun. Now I can, you know, have like real conversations with my kids about history and politics and science. So yeah, with each stage, it doesn't get any easier. I guess you can also throw in an analogy to drug development. But you know, each stage is just, you know, so rich and textured. So that's also, been a great journey.
That sounds like a perfect point to end on. I don't think you can top your analogy there. Deedon, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ross. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.